Good morning, Ms. O'Daniel.
Good morning, Your Honor and Your Honors. My name is Catherine O'Daniel, and I'm here on behalf of the appellant, Eric Michael Cheek, who is currently incarcerated within the Bureau of Prisons in California, serving a 576-month sentence. 576 months divided by 12 equals 48. Mr. Cheek is only 39. According to the Center for Disease Control, he was 37 at the time of trial, 38 at the time of sentencing, and today I believe he's 39.
Thank you.
You're welcome. If Mr. Cheek is extraordinarily lucky and extraordinarily healthy and avails himself of all of the possible good time allowances, he will only have been dead 6 years at the time that this current sentence is due to expire. The Center for Disease Control has calculated Mr. Cheek's expected life expectancy at 72.6 years. And because of that, because he can be expected to live to be 72 and a half years old, a sentence that expires technically when he is 86 years old, but possibly when he is 78 years old with good time, in our view, can only be considered a de facto life sentence. And it is our position that it can't be presumptively reasonable, although it is a within-guideline sentence technically. The reality, the cold, hard, and inescapable reality, is that Mr. Cheek will not likely survive the sentence. And this was a fact that was never mentioned by the district court. It was raised to the district court, albeit very briefly, by trial counsel, but it was never addressed or considered or mentioned by the sentencing court. And instead, the sentencing court focused on one of the potentially or arguably 13 factors that are found in 3553 Section A, and that is the history and characteristics of Mr. Cheek. And the district court narrowed in on one of his one element in the history and characteristics of him personally, and that is his criminal history. I do not stand before this court and argue that it's not a serious, long criminal history, and I believe there are about 9 or 10 criminal convictions, all of which were drug-related. There were 9 criminal history points which were considered when the guideline calculation was calculated, the guideline range was calculated, at a level 42, criminal history category of 4, yielding a range of 360 to life.
Here's what I see as a big problem. 5 of the 7 prior felonies were indisputably too old to be collaterally challenged. And whether or not the court had engaged in, the 851B colloquy, he qualified for the enhancement.
He did qualify under the 851. That's true. And I was not even going to really argue that issue to the court. I've simply raised that by way of preservation in case, and hope springs eternal, in case the United States Supreme Court should ever reverse itself on Almendarez-Torres.
Yeah.
That's the reason that issue is raised, by way of preservation. But Your Honor is absolutely right. He would have been stopped from challenging those convictions because they were definitely solid and more than 5 years old.
Can you distinguish the Williams case on the Section 851 claim, or would you prefer not to get into that any further?
I would actually prefer to spend my time on the de facto life sentence. Thank you very much, Your Honor.
Sure thing.
And with respect to that, this year, Your Honors decided United States versus Patrick. And that was a case where this court gave guidance to other district courts and stated a district court, in rendering sentence, need not exhaustively drone on about each one of the factors at 3553A, but must state enough and put enough in the record to demonstrate on review that the court has actually exercised discretion. The court realizes what options are at its disposal and must also show a reasoned basis for exercising such discretion. In this case, and also this court counseled that district courts ought to consider the characteristics of defendants and explain how those characteristics influence their decision. In that case in Patrick, the defendant had provided cooperation, and it was significant enough to merit a 5K1, and the government moved for a sentence of 300 months, still a significant sentence, but asked the court to run that sentence concurrently with a 20-year state court sentence. Instead, the district court in Patrick gave a sentence of 360 months consecutive to the 20-year sentence, which rendered a bulk sentence of 600 months. This court reversed and reasoned that the record was insufficient to show that the district court appreciated that that was a de facto life sentence. And another reason for the reversal is this court wondered why the district court felt that a sentence so much harsher than what the government was requesting in that case was necessary.
The government here requested 40 years?
Yes, Your Honor. Mm-hmm. The government, at the time of sentencing, felt that 40 years, in light of the defendant's criminal history, was a reasonable sentence that was sufficient but not greater than necessary to respect all the factors of 3553A and B. In this case, the court went well beyond what the government was asking by 96 months. And we have a criminal history category that is already woven into the guideline range of 360 to life, and yet it was the one factor that the district court cited when sentencing Mr. Cheek to a de facto life sentence. And in Patrick, certain language I thought was very applicable to this particular case. This court held that a sentence of life in prison is notably harsher than a sentence that even stops just short of that, and that as a result of that, death in prison ought not to be ordered lightly. In this case, when you look at the court's comments in sentencing Mr. Cheek to life in prison, essentially 576 months, the comments were seven paragraphs long. Most of those were the district court reading the 3553A factors and stating, these are more than just words in the book. I've considered them. We say them every time. And having said that, not much else needs to be said, the court said. And instead of having pause before sentencing someone to essentially life in prison, the district court in this case said, I really have no qualms about the sentence for you. And whether it's going to cost a lot of money to lock you up, I feel we have no choice but to impose the sentence of 576 months, even though you're not a bad guy. And the not a bad guy rings a familiar bell in a case, Cunningham case, that this court also discussed with respect to de facto life sentences. And in Cunningham, the district court in that case also said, you're not a bad guy, but you've got nine priors, and imposed what was essentially a de facto life sentence, which was ultimately remanded. It's also our contention with respect to Mr. Cheek's 576-month sentence that it does not comply with the 3553A factors. Specifically, our contention is that the district court did not give meaningful consideration to anything other than Mr. Cheek's criminal history, and that sentence is greater than necessary to send the strong message the court clearly wanted to send to Mr. Cheek, greater than necessary to do justice to all of the 3553A factors. It's simply our contention that based on this record, especially a 576-month sentence is not only not just, it isn't justified on this record, especially in light of this court's recent decision in Patrick.
Other than the age issue, which you've already gone through, what issues did he overlook that you think should have been exercised, should have been emphasized, and maybe would have mitigated or come back to something lower? You said that you just blurred through the 3553.
Well,
is there something left out? Now, you say, well, he's a good guy. Does that mean he did a lot of drug dealings without using a gun or something? Or what's missing?
He had absolutely no history of violence, not only in this offense.
So he's a nonviolent criminal.
He was a nonviolent criminal. He lost his mother at a very young age. She left behind a lot of children. he rose up as the father figure and unfortunately decided to try and support the family in that worst of ways. In addition, he provided cooperation. The government does not deny that he provided cooperation with respect to one of the detectives that was intimately involved at trial and through the investigation of this case. That detective, in a different proceeding, and I think years earlier, had been accused of wrongdoing. Mr. Cheek was interviewed and completely backed up that detective and completely disputed and disagreed with the allegations against that detective. That was cooperation that Mr. Cheek argued should have been considered by the district court. He actually did bring that to the district court's attention, but that was among the things that we believe the court didn't consider. And I think our argument really is, according to this record, the only thing the court did consider was Mr. Cheek's criminal history, which had already been considered by the determination of that particular guideline where he landed.
Well, the fact that I guess one of the issues was that all of those crimes had relatively short sentences. Is that correct?
Well, I believe that he got a few supervisions, which turned to probations, which turned to 1 year term of imprisonment, and I believe he did have one or two 5 year sentences in the Illinois Department of Correction.
Mm-hmm.
So, compared to this, relatively minor, absolutely. But as far as your question, he did argue some of those factors about his family circumstances and his lack of a violent past to the court. Ultimately, the court's brief comments indicate that it relied only on his criminal background. And that the court's statement that it was not troubled whatsoever by imposing that type of a sentence in light of this court's precedents is troubling in our view. And finally, with respect to this issue, the district court indicated that it felt it had absolutely no choice but to impose that sentence. And when you take that comment on its face, it indicates it makes us question whether or not the court understood, A, that it was basically a life sentence, and, B, that it had a myriad of other sentencing options available to it. I'm going to briefly turn to one other issue. I know that my light is on, and that is the issue with respect to the expert lay opinion testimony. And in this case, the government filed a pretrial Rule 16 filing indicating that it would call Agent Katie, who was the backbone of this investigation and who was the government's first and last witness at trial. The government labeled his testimony as lay opinion 701 testimony. Yet at trial, Agent Katie took on the dual role of testifying to all of the expert testimony that the government had laid out and had promised would come in through a group supervisor, Johnson, whom the government never called at trial. So Agent Katie, who was not qualified as an expert formally by the court, probably could have been, but Agent Katie drew extensively and all throughout his testimony on his experience in 50 different narcotics investigations, 12 different wiretaps. He explained a number of very technical items to the jury, like magneto discs, Title III's, cooperators, debriefings, on and on and on. And when he explained physically how a wire is conducted, he told the jury, this testimony is going to get very technical. And that word is really kind of a 702 buzzword, because when an expert takes the stand, they're talking about their education, their qualifications, their expertise, versus a lay opinion where you're talking about your knowledge in the scope of this specific investigation. It's our position that Agent Katie crossed the line repeatedly between Rule 701 and Rule 702, both in his testimony and when he was able to give essentially expert opinions to the jury on things that would only come from his body of knowledge as an experienced agent, like chemical composition of crack cocaine, like habits of drug dealers who dilute cocaine to increase profit, things like that. And he specifically even opined that a certain phone call meant 23.5. That must mean $23,500. And that was a phone call between Mr. Cheek and an unidentified male. Agent Cady never debriefed either of these individuals, so he would have to have been drawing from his own experience in order to come up with an opinion that that meant that certain amount of money. And finally, I know I'm out of time.
No, finish your sentence.
Thank you very much. I appreciate that, Your Honor. Agent Cady's opinions didn't, they weren't just verbal to the jury. They were written in the transcript book, and they were contained in margins. Is the government's commentary and this man's opinions were submitted to the jury, and they were taken back with them in the deliberation room. It's our position that that's fundamentally unfair, and we are asking for a reversal and a new trial based on that and a new sentencing hearing. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much. Good morning. Good morning. Yes, good morning, Mr. Meisler.
Good morning, Your Honor. May it please the Court, Scott Meisler on behalf of the United States. I'd like to address the issues in kind of reverse order where Mr. Daniel left off, if that's okay. Now, the lay versus expert testimony issue was not preserved below, so that's before this Court concededly on plain error review. And it's our position that there was no error, and certainly no plain error and no prejudicial error in the admission of that testimony, because the agent's testimony followed exactly the line that this Court has drawn in the cases going from Oriedo in 2007 to the Moreland decision earlier this year, and that is basically whether the agent's testimony was based on his knowledge acquired from the particular circumstances of this investigation as compared to knowledge that was gained in prior investigations and brought to bear on the facts of this case. And the government cited the Rollins decision from this Court, which explicates that line in its Rule 16 filing here, and basically adhered to exactly the guidance that was given in the Court's prior cases.
Yeah, but much of this testimony was actually expert opinion. I mean, it just can't, I don't see how you could, you know, view it any other way, but is it harmless error? I mean, I view it as error here. I think the Court erred.
Well, I think we'd have to go kind of piece by piece. I would certainly disagree with you, Your Honor, on the code word issue. That was the main focus of the briefing, was the coded language. And again, if we're looking at the Rollins case, if we're looking at Moreland, this case strikes me as very similar to the circumstances in Moreland where agents in a methamphetamine investigation or a drug investigation learn that the conspirators there called methamphetamine blue. They learn they called marijuana green or scenery. This is very similar to that circumstance. And so if we're talking about plain error. I'm sorry.
Yeah, we are talking. But there's no question that, that we're talking about plain error. But I do think that the district courts have to be more careful about the government slipping in expert testimony under the guise of lay opinion. This agent is so clearly giving expert testimony, should have been properly qualified. It may very well just be harmless error in this case.
Well, I'll make one more pitch on the no error point, and I'll turn to harmlessness. But my one pitch would just be to look at the cases Your Honor mentioned about dual-purpose testimony and whether the agent slid back and forth between expert and lay testimony. And what the Court, both in the York case cited in the defendant's reply brief and in the Moreland case I mentioned, what the Court has said there is that the key is how are the questions phrased, how are the answers given? And I wrote down, just in taking notes for argument today, numerous instances between transcript pages 92 and 105 of Agent Cady's testimony where the prosecutor's question follows the form that this Court said you should use in York and Moreland, which is based on your particular knowledge from this case. And that's what the Court's guidance has been. That's what the government adhered to there. So I don't think it was error at all. But turning to the issue of harmlessness, in cases like York, in the Gayton case from this Court and from Rollins itself, the Court has found harmlessness in all those cases. It basically said even if there was an error here, it was harmless. The Figueroa-Lopez case cited by the defendant in his reply brief found error, improper expert testimony in the guise of lay testimony, and said error because, exactly as Judge Rovner said, the agent just could have been qualified. And instead of waiving his – sorry.
I didn't mean to interrupt you, but because of his full involvement in the case – in investigation and all that. I mean, he was certainly a lay witness from the standpoint of having been totally involved, I assume.
Yes, Your Honor, and that's kind of what the...
Would he be then, would it be proper to lay to label him as a lay witness with a lot of expertise?
Well, you know, again,
because it seems to me that over the years we've had this, where these people that do this routinely really know a whole lot. Now, maybe there was something external that he brought in, but if it focused strictly on the language they used in this particular case and he understood what it was, I don't know why. I'm just looking at it from that standpoint. Yes, maybe, I think she mentioned, he probably could have been qualified as an expert if that were necessary. But I'm listening. I'm not just trying to figure out the right or wrong. I just look at it from the way I see it.
No, I think Your Honor's alluding to the difficulties of dual-purpose testimony. Again, we think the line this court has drawn was adhered to in this case. But what the Moreland case says is that if a judge gets into the weeds of distinguishing which part of the agent's testimony is lay versus expert, that actually can be confusing to a jury. That's why I was reciting the guidance of Moreland, which says the best way to do this is to give an instruction on the caution that should be given to expert testimony and to have the questions and the answers phrased properly. The latter was done here. The former was not, because it wasn't requested. That's why we're on plain error here. There was no objection. The government had initially submitted the pattern expert testimony instruction from the circuit, but withdrew it when it was determined without objection that the agent gave lay testimony. The judge offered to the defense, said, if you want to resubmit this instruction, I'm happy to consider giving it, but defense never did so, and that's at pages 757 and 758 of the transcript.
Did you anticipate having an expert that didn't testify?
Yes, in the Rule 16 disclosure beforehand, there were a number of experts listed, including a supervisory DEA agent who was also going to testify about code words, not from this investigation, not specific to this investigation, but generally about code and veiled language used by drug dealers. He was never called. He wasn't necessary. And as far as the other experts in that disclosure, much of their testimony was admitted by stipulation. So they were never called. And that's why the court never gave the instruction.
Now, the issue of the annotated transcripts going back, on what theory could that possibly have been proper?
Well, I think this court has given district courts broad discretion about whether transcripts go back in the first place.
I'm not talking about transcripts going back. I'm talking about the fact they were annotated by the agent.
Well, they were annotated in the sense that there were brackets containing either commentary or explanations, and the jury heard the stipulation read at least twice into the record that the rest of the recordings were accurately transcribed, but the parties would not agreeing to this commentary by the government in brackets that there was no agreement as to the accuracy of that information. So the jury twice heard that.
Are you saying that there was an actual instruction regarding how to treat the annotations?
There was an instruction from the court, but there was not an instruction from the court as part of its final instructions. To my recollection, there was a stipulation read to the jury at least twice that informed them that the parties did not dispute the accuracy of everything else in the transcript except for the bracketed information.
I mean, could you ever cite a case where we approved of a jury getting transcripts that have been annotated with lay opinions of a government witness? Government agent?
The closest case.
Without an instruction regarding how to treat those annotations? Don't look at them?
The closest case I would cite, Your Honor, is a case I think it's not cited in the briefing, is a case called United States versus Breland, Breland, 356 F3rd 787. And that probably speaks more to the issue I mentioned earlier, just about the general discretion of courts about how to handle transcripts in terms of putting them before a jury.
Is that a Seventh Circuit
case? It's a Seventh Circuit case, Breland.
So it's 356 F3rd.
787 is a 2004 decision. That's what I wrote down. But I think, again, I understand the court's concern there. It wouldn't substantively, Your Honor, be that different, I think, from the agent giving the testimony he gave and a juror writing down each time they got to that spot.
I know, but
in the
that
notes.
Didn't. That's not what happened.
It's not what happened. But I think substantively it's the same. And looking back now, perhaps, would a curative instruction have been proper? Would it have been more helpful? Possibly, maybe. But one was not requested. That's why we're on plain error review here. And even if we can't point to a case that approves this exact practice, on plain error review, it's the defendant's burden to point to a case that currently prohibits it to show a clear and obvious error at the time of appellate review. So I guess that would be basically what I have to say about the expert versus lay issue. I guess the last thing I'll mention about that, Your Honor, is some of the some of the examples of other allegedly expert testimony that Ms. O'Daniel mentioned in her presentation don't strike me as obvious expert testimony. Again, if they're borderline, something like saying that a main ingredient in crack cocaine is cocaine. It's kind of self-evident from the name. We pointed in our brief to testimony from other witnesses who discussed watching another co-conspirator cook crack cocaine out of a white powder. So the government certainly could have elicited the same testimony from any lay witness, any of the cooperators in this case. The price mentions from the recorded phone calls, mentioning the price and the fact that some diluted versions of drugs cost less, that came in the context of the agent comparing the price of diluted drugs versus pure drugs. And so those came kind of back-to-back in pages in the transcript. So, again, that was information the agent would have learned as part of the investigation. That's not obviously improper lay testimony.
Were these transcripts supplemental to actual recordings?
I'm sorry.
I thought I understood these transcripts were supposed to be so they could understand recordings.
That's correct, Your Honor.
So they're supposed to base their opinion on the recordings, supplemented by, maybe they were hard to understand or something. I don't know why.
Yes, and that instruction, I should say, Your Honor, was given. That's the typical instruction, that the tapes are the evidence. The transcripts are simply aids to help the jury understand them. And that pattern instruction was given, that cautionary instruction, both before the tapes were played and at the end of trial. So that cautionary instruction was in the record. And on the sentence, I want to distinguish between the two kinds of challenges that the defendant is presenting, like procedural unreasonableness and substantive unreasonableness. Now, substantively, this is a within-guidelines sentence, and so it's entitled to presumption of reasonableness. And I'm not aware of any cases from this circuit holding otherwise, even where a sentence is either actually life or a de facto life sentence. It's a within-guidelines sentence. It's entitled to that presumption as a matter of substantive reasonableness here. And so I think that's what we basically argue in that point, is the judge had wide discretion from 360 up and properly exercised that discretion. He was allowed to consider and give more weight to one factor, the criminal history, than just that factor was accorded just by the guidelines themselves. The judge is allowed to think that one factor trumps the other ones, and as a substantive matter, there's no gross abuse of discretion here in imposing this long sentence. Procedurally, that's where the Patrick and Cunningham line of cases come in. I think this case is quite distinguishable from Patrick. Patrick, Ms. O'Daniel accurately described Patrick, but that was a case where this court found it very troublesome because the judge on the one hand said, you know what, you cooperated with state authorities. I'm not going to give you life. I could give you life under the guidelines. I'm not going to do that. And then went ahead and turned around and imposed the sentence by running it consecutively that amounted to life. And this court was very troubled that the judge would say one thing on the one hand, something else on the other hand, and not seemingly understand that he was imposing an extremely lengthy sentence that would exceed the defendant's lifespan. Here we don't have that. It's true that Patrick hadn't come out. The Craig decision with Judge Posner's concurrence hadn't come out by the time of the sentencing here. But defense counsel did mention that Mr. Cheek would be elderly if he was ever released from prison. The judge was aware of that. And when he went through the factors, it jumped out to him that the defendant had basically a life of crime, showed no signs of slowing down, had basically done nothing else but deal drugs. And again, the judge had presided over a case in which the government played recorded calls from when Mr. Cheek was in prison a week before he got out in 2010, calling his future and past co-conspirators, planning to resume drug dealing when he got out. So the judge was faced with someone who was a terrible record, who was kind of an unrepentant recidivist, and who the judge really felt could not be put back on the streets. So that's what the judge was facing here. His explanation didn't take up many, many pages of the transcript. But Patrick itself says it has to be enough for this court to understand what the judge was thinking and why he did it. And we think that standard is met here.
The government recommended 40, is that right?
The government recommended at least 40. The government twice recommended a guideline sentence, and the page of the transcript, I'm sorry, Your Honor, I lost the page, but it's page 45. The opening statement from the prosecutor was, we were asking for a sentence of not less than 40 years in prison, not less than. And again, at the end said 40 years or within the guidelines. So the court is not bound by the government's recommendation, just as when it goes down from that recommendation, 40 years would have been sufficient in our view. But if we're talking about the court's exercise of discretion, we have no hesitance defending the court's decision to go above that. Thank you.
So, Daniel, you used your time, but I'm going to give you two more minutes.
opening argument before the jury, the government told the jury, you won't find swans swimming in the sewers of Cicero. And to your point, Justice Roedner, about harmlessness, when these witnesses get up on the stand and some say crack cocaine and some say powder cocaine, but the thing that they have in common is that is the code name for that is girl. It's either crack or powder, but it's called girl. And then you have, against the backdrop of these cooperators who have decorated criminal histories in their own rights, you have Agent Katie, who has a wealth of experience, and he takes the stand, and he stands in contradistinction to them. Yet he writes crack slash powder, and he puts it in brackets, and that is his lay and expert opinion as to what the substances were. It conveys to the jury the message that these are interchangeable. And this jury gets one form of verdict with respect to cocaine, and that says guilty or not guilty of crack cocaine. There never was a special verdict form or any mention of powder cocaine. So I don't think it can be, I personally don't view it, and I hope that the court will share my view, as harmless for Agent Katie to cross the line between 701 and 702 testimony. And there is a case, and I apologize, I know it's in my brief, but talks about the specific danger of crossing back and forth between 701 and 702 is that a jury will become smitten and over-persuaded that this layperson is an expert. And thank you very much, Your Honors, for your consideration.
Well, and thanks to both of you for being here. What can I say? The case will be taken under advisement.